But I remembered back when I was in the police academy and our defensive tactics instructor used to have us bring a photograph of the people we loved the most to class. And as we were learning different techniques to defend ourselves, we were to look at that photograph because he reasoned you will fight harder for the people you love than you will fight for yourself.
Well, hello, Terry. Thank you for making it today.
Well, Bryce, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah, same here. So let's start off by talking about you. Can you just let our listeners know about Terry, who's Terry, and, you know, just your life story?
Sure. So I was born on the south side of Chicago, the third largest city in the United States. You can't tell this from my voice or from looking at me, but I'm 6'8" tall, and I played college basketball despite having three knee surgeries in high school. When I graduated from college, I moved home to find a job. I was actually the first person in my family to graduate from college, and I was all set to make my mark on the world with my newly obtained business administration degree. And I look back now and realize just how little I knew about business because I had a degree. Fortunately, I was able to find that first job in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, which is a fast food chain here in the United States, and I guess actually they're globally. Unfortunately, I lived with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mother care for my father and my grandmother who were dying of different forms of cancer. Professionally, as I said, started out in marketing. Then I moved to hospital administration. And then I took a major pivot in my life and became a police officer. And part of what I did in law enforcement was I was a SWAT team hostage negotiator. After my police career, I started a school security consulting business. I coached girls' high school basketball, became an author in 2020. But for the last 10, almost 11 years now, I've been battling a rare form of cancer, a rare form of melanoma. And then I guess finally, my wife and I have been married for 30 years. We have one child, a daughter, who's an officer in the military here in the United States.
Thanks, Terry. That was a great introduction. And I would say you've had a pretty, pretty eventful life. I'd like to start by talking about your early days. So growing up, what was that like for you? And, you know, let's maybe talk about your childhood. What was that like?
Yeah, I was very lucky, very fortunate. I am the oldest of three boys, so I have two brothers and my mom and dad. And, you know, my story is one where our parents taught us the value of family, the value of caring for each other, supporting each other, and loving each other. And both of my brothers and I, we were all athletes. We were all involved in different sports. And so my parents did what I used to call divide and conquer parenting, where, you know, Terry's got a game at this time and my dad would go with me to that. But at the same time, my brother had a practice or he had a game, you know, in something else. And so my mother would go to that. So they were always, you know, sort of dividing and conquering, as I used to say. So it was great growing up. I mean, I'm still very close to my brothers. They came to visit me. They live in Chicago. I live in Colorado now in the U.S. And they came to visit me right before, they're both in education, before school started in August. And they were here for 3 days. We did not leave the house. We did not turn on the television or anything like that. We just spent 3 days laughing and telling stories about what it was like growing up. So I love my brothers. They're still very active in my life. My father passed away shortly after I graduated from college, but my mother is almost 88 years old and she's still with us as well. So it's great. It's great having my family and I had a great childhood.
That's amazing. And so now, how would you say they have played a role in your life as, I wanted to say, what role have they played in supporting you through your battle with cancer? But maybe before we get there, we should talk about how you dealt with, how you're handling your battle with cancer.
Yeah, I'll try to give you a quick version, but it's been 11 years, so I'll do the best I can in terms of how this started. At the time, when I developed cancer, I was a girls' high school basketball coach in Texas here in the U.S., and I had a callus break open on the bottom of my foot, right below my third toe. And initially, I didn't think much of it because as a coach, you're on your feet a lot. But after a few weeks of it not healing, I made an appointment and went to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor friend of mine. And he took an x-ray and he said, "Terry, I think you have a little cyst in there and I can cut it out." And he did. And he sent it off to pathology to have it looked at. And then 2 weeks later, I received a call from him. And as I mentioned, he was a friend of mine. And the more difficulty he was having explaining to me what was going on, the more frightened I was becoming. Until finally, he just laid it out for me. He said, "Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years. I have never seen this form of cancer that you have. I have a very rare form of melanoma, which most people think is too much exposure to the sun, but this has nothing to do with sun exposure. It's a rare form of melanoma that appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands." And so I was treated at MD Anderson Cancer Center here in the United States, probably one of the best cancer hospitals, maybe in the world. And they took out the tumor on the bottom of my foot. They did surgery to take out all the lymph nodes in my left groin. And then when I healed, my doctor put me on a weekly injection of a drug called interferon to help keep the disease from coming back. The side effects of interferon were that it gave me severe flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week after each injection. And imagine having the flu every week for 5 years. And that's what I did. I took an injection every week for 5 years. Eventually, I had to stop the drug because it became too toxic to my body. Almost immediately, the cancer came back in the exact same spot on my foot. That necessitated the amputation of my left foot in 2018. Cancer worked its way up my leg in 2019, requiring two more surgeries. And then finally in 2020, right in the middle of the pandemic, an undiagnosed tumor kind of in my ankle area grew large enough that it fractured my tibia, my shin bone. And my only recourse during the COVID pandemic was to have my left leg amputated above the knee. And I also found out I had tumors in my lungs, which I'm still being treated for. And I know that sounds like a very ugly journey, and it certainly has been. But I'll tell you two things. Number one, I don't think you know yourself until you've been tested by some form of adversity. And secondly, I think cancer has made me a better human being.
Wow. You know, the last statement you made is something I never really expected to hear. You said cancer has made you a better human being. I do know that when we face difficulties in life, we discover who we truly are. And then sometimes you think you're a great person, but it's probably because you haven't been put through any challenges that make you reveal the other side of yourself. And sometimes you think you have no strength at all, but then you face adversity that makes you rise up to the challenge and be more than you ever thought you could be. So I'm truly inspired to hear that you came to that conclusion after all these experiences. So where did you...
Well, thank you. I think we all do it. I guess I would ask you, I mean, has there been a time in your life where you've become more than you thought you could be?
Well, interesting. I would say when I had to leave home, so I left home at the age of 17. I'm home right now, but at the age of 17, I left home for the first time. Well, by home, I mean the country itself. I left Nigeria for the first time to go to Russia to study chemical engineering. So it was a scholarship given by the Nigerian government as part of a bilateral agreement between the Nigerian government and the Russian government. So the challenge was I had to learn Russian language because the language of instruction was Russian and not English. And at first I thought, yeah, you know, it'll be fine. There are people who've done it before, so it should be okay. So I guess I wasn't scared initially, but when I started learning, we studied the language for 7 months thereabout. My first class of undergrad, after studying Russian for these 7 months, I understood nothing, like absolutely nothing. You know, if I didn't see the formulas on the board or if I didn't have the timetable, I couldn't have known if we were having a chemistry class or a physics class. It's like, I understood absolutely nothing. And, you know, at that moment, you just feel like, what am I doing here? Why did I come here? And you have two choices at that point. Succumb to the feeling of defeat or rise up to the challenge, because studying was hard, especially when you're an A student, because I had always been an A student before now. And I didn't even study much. I mean, of course, for our final exams, I had to study a lot intensely, but I wouldn't say I studied hard, like crazy on a normal day. It's just that I was able to assimilate really quickly. So that had been the norm for me. And now at this stage, I had to study really intensely. So maybe what a Russian would study for 1 hour would take me like 5 hours initially, because, you know, you spend so much time translating and you feel really dumb initially, because for someone who is used to expressing themselves so easily, suddenly you're so limited. Suddenly it's like you have to deal with that feeling of, I don't know, you have to be willing to look stupid, because every time you open your mouth, you're probably going to make a mistake. You're going to hear some snares. People are going to laugh a little. And then you have to get through that stage to the point where you're confident. So I would say I never knew that I could do that till now. It's still a bit surprising when I really think about it. I mean, I got used to it, but if I really sit and think about it, it's still a bit shocking. And I guess that inspired me to go on and learn Chinese. So I self-study Chinese till now. And it's going pretty great. So when I have conversations with native speakers, they're like, oh, you have a great accent. Like, you know, you sound like a native. I don't know that many words, but I guess when it comes to the accent, I have that down, sort of. And it's interesting. So, yeah.
So you know what I'm talking about. I experienced it.
Well, I wouldn't really call this adversity. it's a form of adversity, but it's not like the craziest thing in the world. Yeah. I mean, growing up was a bit more challenging than that, I guess. Like, financially, we had more challenges, but I guess I was too young to comprehend it. And so, I don't want to say the worst is still ahead, but what I mean is I haven't really had terrible challenges, let's put it that way.
Okay.
So I was going to ask how you found the courage to rise up to the challenge. So what inspired you? Because is it something from the way you were brought up? Is it the people you had around you? So what did you tell yourself when all this started hitting you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a human being. I'm not Superman or anything like that. You know, I when I first found this out, I think I went through all the stages that we would associate, you know, with grief. First, it was denial. You know, I can't possibly have cancer. I've done everything right in my life. And then you sort of get mad. And then you start to bargain. You know, our daughter was in high school when I was diagnosed with cancer. So it was, okay, God, let me, you know, live long enough to see her graduate from high school. And then I got a little down, a little depressed. But then I just got to a point where, you know, this sucks, for lack of a better word, but I'm going to have to embrace that suck. I don't like the cards that I have been dealt, but I'm going to have to play these cards to the best of my ability. And I think one of the things that helped me was I look back on my athletic career, on playing basketball. You know, I started playing basketball when I was 9, and I played all the way up till I was 21, till I graduated from college. And basketball is a team sport. And I think one of the things that team sports, or any team that you're on, for me it was sports, I think what team sports taught me was the importance of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. You know, you realize on a team that not only if you don't do your job, you let yourself down, but you also let your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down, et cetera. Yeah. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is this game of life. So I am on a clinical trial drug now that more than likely is not going to save my life, but it may save the life of somebody 5 years from now, 10 years from now, based on the data that the doctors are taking from my blood tests and my scans and things like that. So for me right now, that's being part of something that's bigger than myself. It's not just about me. It's about what impact my life may have on somebody that I don't even know long after I'm probably gone.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. So when you started to think about all this, the team spirit and all of that, you thought about it with regard to the drug specifically, when you said, your team depends on you and what you're going to do is going to affect your team. So you're talking specifically with regards to how this drug is going to help people in the future.
I mean, that's the way I look at it now. I go every 3 weeks to the hospital. I've been going every 3 weeks for the last 2.5 years. I spend the week at the hospital. I am given a drug every day. It reacts very violently with my body. I throw up. I shake violently. I have a headache. I have the chills. I have all these things. And even my nurses look at me like, why do you keep doing this? You know, why do you keep putting yourself through this? And the way I look at it is, yeah, I understand it's ugly and it hurts me and things like that, but it's not something I can't handle. So far, I've been able to handle it, but it's bigger than me. This isn't about me. This isn't about I'm going to save my life, because it's probably not going to save my life, but it may save the life of somebody else years from now. And if that's the case, then maybe that's the legacy that I will leave, you know. And again, it'll be a legacy where I don't know who it helps. I don't know who that person is. I'll never meet them. But if that helps them to cure their disease so they can stay with their family, that to me is being part of something that's bigger than myself.
And that's great. I think there are very few people who would actually, in such a situation, think about others. So how about your family? How have they handled this so far? What's been the reaction?
That's a great question. And, you know, I think certainly cancer, disease maybe in general, tends to isolate us from, you know, first our friends and then our family. And then even to a degree, isolates us from ourselves. I mean, I've been very lucky. I have it's just my daughter and my wife and I. I mean, I do have brothers and my mother's alive and things like that, but they're in another state, so I don't see them all the time. And our daughter's married and is in the military. But I guess, you know, I'll give you a funny story. When I had my leg amputated, my doctor wanted to put me on chemotherapy. And I was like, I looked at him and I said, is it going to save my life? And he said, probably not, but it might buy you some more time. And I was 8 years into this cancer journey. And I kind of looked at him like, well, if the outcome is going to be the same, if I'm going to die, I don't know if I want to take chemotherapy and go through all that ugliness. I said, but I'll go home and I'll talk to my family. And this story, it's kind of funny, but it really did happen this way. So I go home and I start talking to my wife and daughter. And my daughter's immediately like, all right, we need a family meeting. I'm like, family meeting? There's three of us. It's not like we got a board here or something like that, you know? So we end up sitting around the kitchen table and individually talking about how everybody feels about me taking chemotherapy. And then my daughter's like, all right, let's take a vote. How many people want dad to have chemotherapy? And my wife and daughter raised their hand, and I'm like, wait a minute, am I getting outvoted or something that I don't want to do? But I remembered back when I was in the police academy and our defensive tactics instructor used to have us bring a photograph of the people we loved the most to class. And as we were learning different techniques to defend ourselves, we were to look at that photograph because he reasoned you will fight harder for the people you love than you will fight for yourself. So I ended up taking chemotherapy, not because I wanted to, but because I love my family more than I love myself. And looking back on it, it was the right thing to do because it was the bridge that got me to the drug that I'm on now. So it's a funny story, but it really did happen that way. And so just understand that, you know, you'll fight harder for the people you love than you'll fight for yourself.
Yeah. And, you know, having them around you, also just remembering that they need you around, that's enough. It's usually enough inspiration to keep going.
It is. One of the side effects of this trial drug that I'm on is I have a hypersensitivity to vaccines. So right before Thanksgiving, I had my booster shot for COVID. And it put me in the hospital for 4 days. And I remember being in the emergency room, and I my blood pressure was low, my heartbeat was high, I had a high fever, I was throwing up and everything. And the doctor came in and he said, if you were to code, if you were to die, would you want us to try to revive you and bring you back? And I looked at my wife and I said, you decide. I said, because at that point in time, I didn't care whether I lived or died. I was hurting so bad. I just didn't care. And she looked at the doctor and she said, I want him to come home. So if something happens like that, I want you to bring him back. I want you to try to bring him back. And that, so, you know, I don't know if that was selfish of me to make her make that decision, but it was, at, like I said, at that point in my life, I didn't care. If I died, great. If I lived, great too. It really didn't matter to me. I was in so much agony at that point.
Yeah, I see. And so what about your daughter? Is she part of, apart from the family meeting, the vote, is she normally part of the decision-making process? And how do you think all of this has changed her? Because I imagine this process is enough to change a person. So,
oh, it certainly is.
Yeah, what do you think has been
you're absolutely right.
The impact on her?
Yeah, I mean, she went, like I said, when I was first diagnosed, she was in high school. And I remember my second surgery, I had 40 staples in my groin. So in my abdomen, through my groin, and kind of into my thigh. And when I came home, I had to get upstairs to the bedroom. And it was 7 steps up to a landing, then a landing, and then 7 more steps. And I remember I got to the landing, and I was hurting so bad. The staples were pulling and everything like that. It felt like my incision was on fire. And I said to my wife and daughter, I said, look, I just got to sit down. I got to rest. I'm 6'8", 240 pounds. So they're not going to give me up. And my daughter was like, no, Dad, you can't sit down. And she literally grabbed me by my shirt, and my wife kind of pushed from the back, and they got me up those last 7 stairs. And so sometimes I ask people, you know, who in your life is pushing or pulling you, you know, towards your goals? Or maybe even more importantly, who are you pushing and pulling toward their goals? So, I mean, yes, this has had an impact on her. I mean, she and I are very close. And we talk all the time, and it hasn't been easy, but you know, you teach your children how to live. And I think at this point in my life, I'm also teaching my daughter how to die as well.
That's amazing. I think your daughter is a really strong young lady, and I want to know how you raise her, because she seems to have a sense of responsibility, but not just that, but she seems to have this ability to bear more than just her burden, you know? Because a lot of kids, what happens is when their parents face this sort of adversity, you know, we're so used to our parents being our earth and sky, and it looks like if anything happens to them, the world is just going to collapse. But she seems to have this amazing ability to not just be strong for herself, but also be strong for you. And how did you raise her to help her grow into such a person?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think a couple of things that I would say to that. I would say, first of all, we were her parent. We weren't her friend. You know, and as parents, you have to make hard decisions. You have to make difficult decisions that your kids may not like, but it's in their best interest. And the other thing I think we did is we didn't helicopter parent her so much. You know, there was a time when she was in grade school where she was getting bullied. And we said to her, do you want us to get involved? Do you want us to, you know, to help? And she was like, no, I'll take care of it. And so, you know, as long as she was not physically in danger, we thought, well, okay, so we'll just back off. You figure this out. You figure out how you're going to deal with this other student in your class who's bullying you. You figure it out, you know? And so I guess we let our daughter fail. We let her make mistakes. We let her, you know, realize how resilient she could be without us, because there'll come a day, obviously, where my wife and I will be gone, and she will have to live the same way, you know, that she's living now. And I think what I learned, and I talked about this earlier, what did my parents teach us? The importance of caring for each other, loving each other, and supporting each other. I think that's what we did with our daughter. And I think when our daughter has children, I hope that's what she will do as well. So I would say, you know, yes, we were there for her, but we also let her make mistakes. We also let her figure it out. We also let her fail and realize that failure, you know, there's a difference between failing and quitting. You know, if you fail, as long as you keep going and keep learning, you're not a quitter. And that's the lesson we wanted her to learn.
Yeah, and I think you did a great job. In terms of helicopter, yeah, there's a helicopter parenting. I think it's becoming even more common these days. It's as though, you know, a lot of parents are, they feel the urge to protect their kids from every single possible danger out there. And I actually didn't think much of this until recently. I guess, you know, since I had the opportunity to leave home at a relatively early age and explore the world and all that, I also got to see the impact of different kinds of parenting on different sorts of people. So for me personally, I had a pretty strict upbringing, and you know, there were a lot of things my parents told me that I didn't agree with, and I thought, you know, they were being overbearing. But as I've grown up, I understand why they made those choices. However, I was also sort of sort of limited in what I could do. So I didn't have a lot of opportunities to fail. And that kind of, you know, made it difficult for me to try new things and explore. And that's something I've been trying to be more intentional about these days. But in terms of the discipline that they brought me up with, I see how that has helped. You know, when you said they know when to be parents and when to be friends. Like now that I'm growing up, you know, all the friendship is coming and we're buddies. But, you know, growing up, they really have to be hard, and you won't like that, especially when you're a teenager. But you will eventually, when you become a man or a woman, then you will understand your parents, not as their kid, but as a man or a woman. So, you know, my take on helicopter parenting is, you know, a parent needs to have the courage, and it takes courage, really. A parent needs to have the courage to let their kid experience some probably, possibly painful things in life, because that's the only way they can be ready for the world, because the world is full of a lot of, you know, the world is dangerous. It can be great, but it also can be dangerous, especially if you're not prepared. So you can protect the kid till like they're what, 18? But at some point, they're going to step out into the world. And if they've been safeguarded all their lives, they're going to be totally unprepared for all the dangers that the world comes with. Yeah.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And I do think you make a really good point that there's a shift at a certain point in time where you go from being the parent to making all the decisions for your kid to having a relationship with your adult children. And you realize that hopefully you gave them the skills, the tools necessary for them to make good decisions in their lives of, you know, about everything, you know, where they live, what kind of job they have, where they go to school, what they do and don't do. But now you don't have that say anymore. You know, they can say to you, you know, you're going, I'll give you a quick story. When I was living at home, my father was dying of cancer and my younger brother was in high school. And I remember one night my brother had a basketball game. And I said to my dad, I'm not going to the game. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to go work out after the game or after I finish my job. And my dad said, no, you're not. You're going to the game. And I'm like, well, excuse me? I'm an adult. I mean, I have my own job. I have, you know, and my dad's like, you're going to the game. I'm like, no, I'm going to work out. My dad said, no, you're going to the game. And my dad threw the family thing right in my face. He said, you know what? Our family has always been about caring each other, loving each other, and supporting each other. Your brother needs you now, so you're going to the gate. And my dad was right. I was just trying to, you know, sort of flex my muscles and, you know, spread my wings and say, hey, look at me. I can do this. But my dad was right. you know, it was like, your brother needs you, you need to be at the game. So I ended up going to the game and found another time, you know, to go and work out. But I was just being stubborn. I was being a jerk. And so, yeah, I mean, family is so important. I mean, I have a very deep faith as well, but faith and family are incredibly important things. And if you have those, I believe, in your life, I call my three F's, faith, family, and friends. If you have those, you can do almost anything because you surround yourself with people that care about you, that support you, that love you, that uplift you, that wants the best for you. And if you've got that, that's a great safety net to try things that are maybe a little scary.
Yeah. So we've talked about, I think we've pretty much covered, well, not covered, but we've talked sufficiently about family. So maybe we can delve a little bit into your faith. How about that?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be more than happy to do that. I've always had a very strong faith. I was raised Roman Catholic, still am Roman Catholic. I think, again, that comes from my parents. I sort of joke, I'm 6'8", I've got a brother that's 6'7", a brother that's 6'6", and my dad was 6'5". So I joke, you know, if you sat behind our family in church growing up, there wasn't a prayer's chance you were going to see anything that was going on, you know, in front of you because we were blocking it. But our 5'8" mother was the boss. You know, it didn't matter how big, tall, strong we were, whatever mom said went. Mom was always, hey, we're going to sit in the front row of church. And we were always like, no, mom, nobody's going to be able to see us, you know, or see what's going on because, you know, we're sitting in the front row. We got to sit in the back because we always wanted to sit in the back. And no, we're sitting in the front row. And so I think our parents, again, taught us the importance of faith, you know, not just religion, but faith, but having a deep, abiding faith in God. And I remember when I had my first knee surgery, this was long before arthroscopic surgery was available, so I have the large scar on the outside of my knee. And I spent 3 or 4 days in the hospital after that operation, which today I would have been home, you know, like that afternoon. But I remember I had a very high fever. I had an infection in the wound, and I was getting pain medication, and I started to hallucinate. And I remember it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I called home and, you know, woke my mother up, and I'm like, Mom, I'm scared. I was like 14 years old. You know, I'm scared. I don't know what's happening. I'm seeing things. And my mom said, I put a rosary in the side table next to your bed. Pull the rosary out and start saying it. And it's amazing how calming that was for me. That kind of calmed me down. And, you know, my parents weren't there, but she'd given me that. And, you know, people have always said to me when I got cancer, who do you blame? Who do you blame because you got cancer? I mean, we're great in the United States about wanting to find fault, you know, in somebody else when we fail. And I said, I don't blame anybody. Well, you must blame your parents. No, I've had all 88 genes that doctors either know of or suspect cause all forms of cancer, and I have no mutations in any of those genes. So no, I don't blame my parents. My parents didn't give me this as a genetic disease. Well, you must blame God then. And I sort of joke with them. I'm like, no, I don't think God got up on a Tuesday morning, checked his to-do list and said, Terry Tucker, cancer today. I don't believe that at all. I know, it's kind of funny. But when I was on interferon, when I was taking those drugs and I was so sick, I had the flu every week, I literally prayed to die. I've always believed there's a difference between living and not dying. And I kind of felt during that time of my cancer journey, I was in the not dying phase. I really wasn't living. I was just trying to survive from day to day. And that survival was 5 years long. And so I prayed to die. And I obviously didn't die. But I think what God did was give me the strength to continue to go on and continue to move forward. And I'll give you one final story. When I had these tumors in my lungs initially, I had my leg amputated. My doctor showed me my CAT scan, and I have no medical background. I don't know how to read a CAT scan, but I kind of know, like, well, that doesn't look like it belongs there and stuff like that. And I had these big tumors in my lungs, and I had fluid all around the pleural spaces, the outside of my lungs. And I remember looking at my oncologist and saying, how was I alive during this? And he kind of smiled and shook his head, and he said, I don't know. You shouldn't have been. Which said to me that God's not done with me yet. You know, when I die, where I die, how I die, way above my pay grade, so I don't spend a lot of time worrying about it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really powerful. And how about if we're going back to family now? But it's like faith and family. So, is this faith also replicated in your family? Like, you know, I mean, your nuclear family.
It is. We raised our daughter to be Catholic. And I think everybody goes on their own faith journey. And you know, you can't force somebody, you know, to be what you want them to be when it comes to God or faith. And there was a time where our daughter kind of got out, you know, she was practicing another faith. She was practicing another religion. And that certainly bothered my wife and I, I'll be honest with you. I'm not going to tell you it didn't. But we realized that she's on her journey. She's going to figure it out. And about a year later, or about a year ago, she came back to the faith that we had raised her to. And I think it was good that she got an opportunity to look at other options, to look at other faiths. Is this good for me? Does this give me what I want in terms of having a relationship with God or, you know, a superior being? And no, it didn't. I want to go back to where I was because that gave me what I needed. So I think for her, it was incredibly educating, incredibly eye-opening to say, I'm going to try something else. That's not working for me. I'm going to go back to what I believe worked for me. So yes, I mean, we raised our daughter to have faith, to believe in something, again, that's bigger than us, that's bigger than ourselves. And, you know, I think the underlying premise of all this is love. You know, and guys, especially here in the United States, we don't talk about love, you know, a lot. And I'm not talking about romantic love. I'm talking about, you know, the love that most of us were created in and the understanding that love is really the most important thing in all our lives. You know, loving ourselves, loving what we do, loving our purpose, loving our creator, loving our family and friends. That's really, at the end of the day, what's most important. You know, we tend to think that we're born empty and we need to fill ourselves up. You know, we need to get a great job and make a lot of money and you know, drive a great car and live in a great house. And we consume, we fill ourselves up. And I kind of look at it just the opposite. Instead of looking at it like we're born empty and we got to fill ourselves up, what if we looked at it as we're born full and our job is to empty ourselves out for the betterment of ourselves, our family, our community, and our friends?
Well, that's a very interesting way of looking at life, and I think very useful as well. So since we're already on that trajectory, let's just talk more about your general message to people. So now, what is it that you do? How do you get your message out? And what is the core thing that you try to tell people whenever you have an opportunity to talk with them?
Yeah, I get my message out by, you know, meeting nice people like you that allow me to come on to the podcast, in all honesty.
My pleasure.
I have been a guest on over 600 podcasts all around the world, and I have met some incredibly good people, some incredibly gracious people, some people that I'm even friends with today. And so really my message is this. I call them my four truths. And I'll give them to you. They're just one sentence each. The first one is control your mind or your mind is going to control you. The second one is embrace the pain and the difficulty that we all experience in life and use that pain and difficulty to make you a stronger and more determined individual. The third one I look at more as a legacy type of truth, and it's this: what you leave behind is what you weave in the hearts of other people. And then the fourth one I think is pretty self-explanatory. As long as you don't quit, you can never be defeated. And so I look at those four truths, kind of, I call them the bedrock of my soul. They're just a good place, I think, to start to build a quality life off of.
Yeah, it's very profound. So your four truths, how did they come about? Do you have any memory of the moment where you just, you know, decided, okay, this has to be one of the core values of my life, maybe for each of them, or if you don't, you know, just what do you remember of the time when you decided, yeah, these would be my four truths?
Yeah, I think the first one about controlling your mind, I think that's incredibly important. It's probably the most important of the four truths. I used to think that there wasn't one that was more important than the other, but the more I live, the more I read, the more I study, the more I think about it, I really think controlling your mind. I mean, we all, whether we admit it or not, we all talk to ourselves. And I always tell people to be very careful with that self-talk, because we all become what we think. And I remember when I was in high school, I mentioned I had those knee surgeries. And when I went back playing basketball, I remember my mind, my brain was putting all kinds of negative thoughts into my mind after those operations. Things like, you know, hey, you're probably a step slower on the basketball court, and college coaches aren't going to be interested in recruiting you to play for their school. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, no, I'm still playing at an elite level, and college coaches are still reaching out about the possibility of playing for their college or university. I realized early that I had to change the narrative. I had to put something positive into my mind, you know, and take out those negative thoughts. So that one I learned pretty early. The part about embracing pain and difficulty, that was harder to learn, because our brains are hardwired to avoid pain and discomfort and to seek pleasure. So to the brain, you know, the status quo, the way things are right now, it's comfortable and familiar and should just be left alone. The problem with that is the only way we grow, the only way we get better, the only way we improve is if we step outside those comfort zones and do things that make us uncomfortable. So I have taken, and I am the biggest wimp in the world, so if I can do this, trust me, anybody can do this. Instead of running from pain, what if you did just the opposite? What if you took that pain and flipped it inside and burned it as fuel and used it as energy to make you more resilient? You can do that. Instead of running away from it, I don't want to get that surgery out. Yeah, it's going to hurt. Yeah, it's going to hurt. But use that pain to make you stronger, to make you tougher. And trust me, like I said, biggest wimp in the world. I can do it. Anybody can do it. So that's the second one. The third one, I think as I've had to deal with my own mortality, the fact I'm probably coming to the end of my life, what's my legacy? What am I leaving to my wife, to my daughter, to the people, you know, that hear me on podcasts, my friends? And it really is what I weave in the hearts of those people. You know, it's the connection that we make with each other that really allows me to live on through them. So I guess that's the third one. And then the last one, the way I look at that is, as long as you don't quit, you can never be defeated. That someday my pain, my ugliness is going to end. May end through surgery, may end through some kind of new drug. Quite frankly, it may end when I die. But if I quit, if I give up, if I give in to pain, then pain will always be a part of my life.
Wow. Well, that's very true. I think it's sometimes it feels easier to give up because, you know, you're tired and, you know, you just want to rest. You just want to take a break from all this. But when you keep fighting, then as long as you haven't let go, then it's not over. But the moment you give up on yourself, then it truly is over, and no matter what anyone else tries to do.
And you just told me the story about what it was like for you to go to Russia. You know, I mean, yeah. You could quit.
Yeah.
I said, no, I'm not going to.
Some people do. Well, not so many, but yeah.
I mean, you know, my story is about cancer. Your story is about persevering through learning a new language and taking difficult courses in another language and stuff. We all have, you know, just because mine's about cancer, I mean, yours is just as valid and important because it taught you a lesson.
Yeah.
Right?
Especially the one about controlling your mind. I would say during my first year, during the language learning process, and also my first year as an undergrad, that was very important, because there were a lot of presuppositions by teachers and by other students that, you know, as a foreigner, it's going to be very difficult for you to make good grades, because you come in and you start learning ABC in Russian, like literally you start from the, do you know how that feels to someone who should be in university? Because I actually started my university program, my undergraduate program in Nigeria. I did that for 1 year and then I got the scholarship. So I just traveled. And so it feels crazy. It's like, okay, what is really going on here? And then people begin to say things like, you know, it's really hard. You hear from people from different countries, it's really hard. The system doesn't treat us well. The teachers just think you're stupid because you're a foreigner. They think you can't. So it got to a point where I deliberately decided that I would not listen to anyone who was saying that. Yes, I know that they've had it difficult in life, but I didn't want to sit and listen to that. I just would literally zone out when anyone started talking about all the difficulties of studying in Russia. I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm well aware that it's difficult. But I started listening to people who were telling me it's possible and started telling me, you know, you can work hard, you can do this. You're going to have to be extra. You have to stand out from the beginning of the class. You have to make yourself, your presence known in the class, let the teacher know you're interested, and then at least they become supportive. You know, that because the bias is makes things difficult. When a teacher just feels, okay, the student is dumb, their relationship with you, especially during oral exams, is very, very discouraging. But when you establish your presence from the beginning, it lets people know that you're serious. And just that change in attitude, knowing, okay, I want this and it's possible, made things different. So I really controlled my thoughts, and anything that made it look like I wasn't going to make it, I absolutely ruled it out. And the people you surround yourself with also helps, because I had senior colleagues who were used to making all A's. So these guys are Nigerian. So, well, I had mostly Nigerians as friends, but these guys were Nigerians who came in just like me, and they had A's in every subject, every single semester. And so I thought, okay, yeah, I could do this. Why don't I learn from them, you know, the steps, what they did and how I can do it. And what I would say I also learned is that a lot of things are not as hard as they seem. Even a lot of impossible things can be done if you just surround yourself with the right people, because our minds are elastic. If we're in an environment where something is the norm, no matter how crazy it is, if it is the norm, we sort of stretch to fit into that. But if you're in a place where failure is the norm, even if you're really smart, you sort of become complacent. So I just had to give myself a new norm and surround myself with people who were used to excellence. Like, they would tell me, you're not coming, because we lived in a general hostel. So they would tell me, you're not coming back here with a B. Don't even think about it. You know, when you get that sort of environment where if you get a B, people are like, no, go talk to the teacher, find out what happened. So you just know that I'm an A student, and that's what I'm going to work towards. Even if it means sleepless nights, I'm going to do the work to make this happen. So yeah, the part about controlling your mind, that's extremely important. I think it applies to, you know, basically every area in life. Yeah.
It does. And I think you learned another valuable lesson. You just said it, that if you surround yourself with people that are better, that are stronger, that are smarter, you stretch, you become, you want to lift yourself up to that level. Versus if you surround yourself with people that are always, they always have drama going on in their life, you know, it's always about them, they don't care about you, you'll sink to that level as well. It's kind of where you put the bar. And my wife and I did that. You know, our daughter is very good at reading, writing, talking, speaking, things like that. And so we made her take things that were hard. And she's like, no, I'm gonna do this because it's easy. It's like, no, we're going to raise the bar for you, because if we put the bar down here, you will rise to that little level. But if we put the bar way up here, you will rise to that level. And we learned that early on with her. So we always made her do things that were harder than she wanted, because we knew she could stretch and get to that point.
Mm. Yeah, that's impressive. You guys were really the A parents.
I don't know about that, but
Okay, so I think we'll finally just talk about your friends. Since we're talking about that, those who you surrounded yourself with, how would you say that has influenced you?
Yeah, you know, one of the things when I got cancer, there were people that I was positive were going to be, you know, there with me. They were going to take this journey with me. And some of those people couldn't deal with it. Some of those people couldn't deal with me, you know, as a guy in my early 50s that were like, ooh, you know, you might die in the next few years. I can't deal with that. I even have a neighbor now across the street who, whenever we talk about, you know, the fact that I planned my funeral and things like that, he can't deal with that. He gets out of that conversation very quickly. And then there were other people who I never thought would be there with me, who I never thought would support me, who have never left my side. So I think it's really incumbent upon you, again, and we just talked about that, you learned at an early age to surround yourself with people that made you better. And I wanted, when I got cancer, I wanted to be around people that didn't feel sorry for me, that weren't going to let me off the hook when things got hard, were going to force me to have to raise the bar for me too. We're going to have to force me, even dealing with the disease, to stretch. And so you learned that at an early age. I'm not sure I learned that as early as you did. So kudos to you for that. Congratulations. But when I did learn it, it was like, who do I want to surround myself with? If you have drama, if you're a negative person, I don't want you anywhere near me. And I've had people come up to me and say to me, gee, Terry, I could never do what you did. And I always kind of look at them, and sometimes I'm in a smart aleck kind of mood, and I'm like, yeah, you're right, you couldn't, because you've already decided in your own mind that you can't do this. Why would you even start something, going into anything, with the idea that I'm not going to be successful at it, or I'm not going to give my best effort? If you're going to start something and you're going to tell yourself, yeah, I'm probably going to fail at this, you know what? My advice to you, just stay in bed. Sleep in that morning, because why spend all that energy if you've already defeated yourself? So I wanted people around me that lifted me up, that strengthened me, that made me a better person with this disease. And that's what I've tried to do since I got cancer.
Well, I think that's very useful because, you know, we often are sympathetic. And when you're going through a hard time, a certain amount of sympathy is necessary, but too much of it is kind of killing, because then it's like you're going through a challenge and some people just expect you to stay down, like, oh, I'm so sorry about this. And, you know, they're hurting, they feel sad for you, but more than that, we need to have people who can push us to say, okay, this has happened. What can we do? Where can we go from here? And often that looks like a sort of military, like a military approach. But, you know, we do need it very often, because if we have people that always let us just stay within our comfort zone and just lay down and say, oh, I don't know what to do, in the long run, it's not very good. It's not very healthy for us.
It's not. You need a purpose. And if you have that purpose, you need people to help you along the road to that purpose. You know, I learned that when my father was dying. He had end-stage breast cancer, which back in the 1980s, for a male, they didn't really know how to treat. And they told him to go home and die. And he lived for 3.5 years. And the reason I believe he did is because he had a purpose. He was in real estate, and he worked up till 2 weeks before he died. And so I kind of took that, you know, put it in the back of my mind and said, you know, when it's my turn, which it is my turn now, I've got to have a purpose. You know, I can't lay in bed all day and think how terrible my life is. I need to do something with my life. And then I also need to surround myself with people that will help me do that, that won't let me off the hook, that won't feel sorry for me. It's like, yeah, you're not feeling good today. Too bad. Get up. Let's go. We got to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, no, I don't feel good. I want to stay. No, get up. Let's go. You want to do this. Again, people that cause you to stretch, allow you to grow in your life. At the end of the day, those people are invaluable to making you successful in life.
Yeah. So I think I'll probably like to take this moment to appreciate my mom, because she's very much that person. Like, she doesn't let me stay sorry for myself for long. And, you know, she tries to be empathetic, but at some point, you just have to get up and move on with life, even if things are hard, because that's just the way things things are. Yeah, she had a difficult childhood, and so she learned to be independent early on. So yeah, she has a very, very, very practical view on life and what you have to do to keep moving. Yeah. So thanks.
Thinking of like your mother.
Yeah. All right. So I think we've been going for quite some time now, and I'd like to give you some time to just say anything extra you think people need to hear, or you know, if you want to throw some questions at me, whatever, I'm cool. So the floor is yours.
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I asked you some questions before we started the recording, and I think I've asked you questions along that line, and it sounds like your parents have had a tremendous influence on you, and I think you understand the importance of them. And you know, my parents, I'm the product of my parents. You are the product of your parents, and you should be very proud, and your parents, I think, should be incredibly proud of you. I mean, there are, when you were telling me that story about, you know, you were in Nigeria, you were going to school, and then you got a scholarship, so many people would have been, yeah, I got a scholarship. There's no way I'm leaving home. There's no way I'm leaving Nigeria. There's no way I'm going to go to a foreign country and try to learn a language and study chemical engineering. I mean, so many people would never have done that. And I'll end it with this for you. There's an entrepreneur here in the United States by the name of Ed Miley. He talks about the four types of people in the world. He said the first type are the unmotivated. And he said that's the vast majority of people. He said the second type are the motivated. Very simple. If I do this, I will get that. You move people, or people are moved by motivation. The third and fourth are the things that we all should try to aspire to. And the first group are the inspirational people. Inspiration coming from in spirit. You move people with the way you conduct yourself, with the way you live your life. And then the last group are the aspirational people, where people want to be like you. You're the kind of young woman I look at and say, you know what? There's going to be a lot of people that want to be like you. There's going to be a lot of people that can learn from you. There's a lot of people that you're going to be able to influence in your life. So it was an incredible pleasure for me to be able to come on your podcast and to talk to you today. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, thank you so much, Terry. That means a lot coming from you.
Well, you've earned it. It's not something I don't say that to too many people, but you're an amazing young woman, and I think the sky's the limit for you. You can do anything you want to do, and I'm sure your parents and your family are incredibly proud of you, and you just figure out what you want to do and go for it, and I'm sure you'll be incredibly successful.
Thank you. All right. This has been a pleasure on my pod. Absolutely great conversation with you, and I've been so inspired. So just want to say I wish you all the best. My regards to your family, and I hope that you're able to inspire so many more people. I'm sure that you will. And I'm just thankful that I had the opportunity to speak with you today.
And I feel exactly the same way about you. So this was good on both sides. Thank you very much for having me on.
Okay. Thank you guys for listening. Until next time, stay happy, stay beautiful. Bye.